It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of the eponymous Harvell and Collins. I love using that word eponymous, Cecil, Wes. Good afternoon to you both.
Well, Wes and I sure do hope we live up to that word.
Oh, you definitely do. I'll tell you what. And more so, I will say, the information we're providing here on this program is phenomenal. And I just want to commend both of you. And again, that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And by the way, just want to make mention of this. These programs are podcast on their website. But on top of that, it's an opportunity. We also have them available here at the radio station. But I just want to make mention of this. Don't hesitate to give them a call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. All right, with that introduction, my apologies. Cecil, Wes, what's on tap today?
Good afternoon. I was sitting here thinking about kind of a little bit about what you were saying, Lockwood, and I think it might be a moment just to take a pause and say, on behalf of Wes and myself, you know, this program with you, Lockwood, started years ago. We have a lot of new people in our community and in our listening area, but I think we're going on a good 20, 25 years of Tuesday programs where Wes and I talk to you about you know, any number of legal topics. And it all started because we wanted to kind of, quite frankly, give back to the community information that Wes and I happen to have, not only through education, but through experience, and to give the community an opportunity to ask questions. If for some reason it's a question in an area of the law that we don't specialize in, like, say, something like, you know, immigration or patent law or copyright, well, we can still talk about it for a minute and then redirect that listener to lawyers that we know that do, in fact, practice in those areas of law. But the whole idea here is to give the general public an opportunity to kind of glean in to some of the issues that we hear on a day-to-day basis, different topics, demystifying, as we say, different aspects of the law. And we enjoy it. I know Wes and I both enjoy it, and others from the law firm who help you from time to time, Lockwood. We've, of course, Andrew has his program, and Julia has been on a few times with me and Wes. And so it's just a good thing and a good opportunity to allow some of this legal knowledge to flow out into the listening public. So I just kind of went off track there, but it's been a long time since we've kind of talked about the history of the program and the purpose of the program.
I like that description a few moments ago, demystifying the law. And you both have worked so diligently to explain the situation so that the audience is a little less intimidated in instances where they do need legal representation and the simplification of just going to ask a question. And we've relied on that so many times. So, yeah, Cecil, Wes, I think this is an important aspect of this program, demystifying and removing that threat, if you will, the intimidation.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So now, so this morning, or this afternoon, rather, Lockwood, let's talk about something that our listeners, I think I've always heard these words, the life estate. What is it? How does that operate? How does it evolve? And let's kind of, again, to repeat the word, let's demystify this concept of a life estate. Now, right out of the gate, I think it's very important that that when I am asked by a client to generate a life estate through a last will and testament or through a deed, I am a bit hesitant, quite frankly. It's an easy out. It's an easy thing for a client to do and to think that that's the solution to their problem. And it's not as if we don't do that, because we certainly do. But there needs to be extensive conversation about creating a life estate. I hereby give my wife the right to live in my house if I die for the remainder of my life, and then I want it to go to my children. Mm-hmm. Or I want my spouse to have the right to the beach house for the rest of their lives and then out to all the grandchildren. So we have to kind of pause when we hear these requests from clients and then begin to discuss the details of what would that look like. And one of the things that comes to mind is that the life tenant, the person who is going to have the life estate, Lockwood, has the responsibility for the property. They're going to need to maintain the property. They're going to need to pay the taxes and the insurance and the upkeep, unless for some reason the document says otherwise. But generally speaking, the life tenant is responsible with the privilege of being able to have the peace and enjoyment of the property. In the law called the quiet enjoyment, they have the responsibility to maintain the property. And so this needs to be kind of clearly understood. Maintaining property this day and time, particularly property, Lockwood, that in coastal communities, in light of Hurricane Milton that's bearing down on Tampa this morning, but by the grace of God, of course, that's us, as we all know. I can't help but think about that every day, that these hurricanes that are so devastating are not here in Carteret County, but they very easily could be. And so the insurance industry, the cost of maintaining a property, the repairs, the upkeep, all of that, these are issues that need to be discussed when you set up a life estate. Wes, take a moment and tell us about the bifurcation of, quote, the life estate versus the remainderment, and tell us what that means.
When you have a life estate interest that you are holding, or you're conveying to someone, then that basically, in the most basic terms, now you can set it like a life estate based on the life of another. That's called per ultra B, or you can make it based on the life of the person who receives it, which is the most common way to do it. Like, okay, I convey to you a life estate interest in this property for the rest, for the rest of your life. And if you don't say for the rest of your life, if it's just a life estate, it's presumed that it's for the rest of your life. And that means you have the right to possess the property. You have the right to use the property as you see fit. Obviously, you have obligations to maintain the property.
Mm-hmm.
You can't create waste. And that connects to our next part, which is the remainder interest. You have to, maintain the insurance, the mortgage, the taxes.
Right.
So there's obligations with it. Also, just very briefly, I would add that it can be conveyed. It's conveyable. I mean, if someone owns a life estate, a property for the rest of their life, they can convey that to someone else. Oh. They could sell their life estate to someone else. But that life estate interest is going to be based on the original holder of the life estate,
right,
not the new owner.
Right.
So when that life estate holder who is conveying it to someone else passes away, then that life estate ends in the person who purchased it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's the way that works. Now, so then that leads us up to, okay, well, where does it go then? Well, if you have a life estate interest, well, where does the property go when the person's life ends?
Right.
Well, when you have a life estate interest, you're going to have a remainderment as well. The remainderment is the person who receives the property upon the end of the life estate. This could be persons of persons. Common way that's seen, Lockwood, is, I convey a life estate to my surviving spouse. Let's say it's a second marriage, and husband and wife in the second marriage are living in the marital home together, but they're children of a previous marriage, or there's just natural children.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I leave that life estate to my surviving spouse for life, her life, and then upon her death, it then passes to my children.
Right.
But then it would pass on to those, you know, two, three, five, however many children there were. So, so that's the breakdown, you know, of how that works with regard to the life estate interest. Now, interestingly, the property can be sold, not just the life estate, but the property in its entirety. Let's say you have a real property in an estate that has to be sold for purposes of paying
taxes,
claims, credits, creditors' debts,
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth, and the property has to be sold, but there's a life estate interest. Well, how do we figure out who gets what when all the property is sold? So you're not going to just sell the life estate. You're not going to just sell the remainder, which is sellable as well, just like the life estate. You're going to sell the property. And then in order to determine how the proceeds from the sale are distributed, they are our government and the IRS, they provide life estate tables. So based on the age of the life estate holder, we're able to make a determination as to the percentage value of the whole that the person would be entitled to upon the sale of the property. So obviously the older you get, the lower your percentage is, because the likelihood you're going to be with us much longer goes down, therefore the value of your life estate is lower. Another issue about life estates that maybe Cecil can hit on a little further would be, we often use life estates in our long-term health care planning that we do.
Mm-hmm.
As we've talked about on the program, we definitely steer folks away from conveying their real estate, their property, their home to their kids without proper planning. That is a question that we get quite often. It is almost universally a mistake to just deed, as they say, the property to the children, because there is a much, much better way to do it by use of particular vehicles, types of trust. And in the work that we do with regard to that, when we set up folks' long-term health care planning, asset protection plan, we almost, and I would say it's really close to 100%, unless it's a very unusual circumstance, we are going to retain a life estate in the name of the, let's say, the parents, the people who we're doing the planning for.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to hold that life estate, and the remainder is primarily what is going to be conveyed and structured properly. That's for multiple reasons. That's because the way adult Medicaid services values and views life estates. That's one reason. Another reason is we want to get the benefit of protecting the property, but we don't want to lose the benefits of being able to stay in our own home. We don't want someone kicking us out of our home. And a huge additional benefit would be that we certainly don't want to convey the real property without retaining the life estate to the next generation, because we lose our step up in tax basis.
Mm-hmm.
And if we retain the life estate, when the mom or dad or whoever the family member is passes, and then the property passes on to the next generation, then that next generation gets the property at the date of death value, so that when they sell the property, if that's what they choose to do, they have essentially no gain. Therefore, there's no capital gains tax due. In the event that we don't retain the life estate, then, you know, that's a mistake. That would be a mistake by the lawyers, in my opinion. That's just not what we do, because the benefits are all around with regard to retaining that life estate, from a planning perspective, for long-term care, for taxes, for control. It checks every box. So using the benefit of a life estate, sometimes referred to, that's the technical term, life estate. As we know, sometimes folks refer to it as lifetime right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the same thing, basically. If you hear someone on the street say, lifetime right, well, that's that's a life estate as well. So lots of benefits and moving parts with regard to the interplay of the life estate and the remainder interest that is that would be conveyed.
There are two parts to a life estate. There's part A is the life tenant, the person who can exercise the right to the property for their lifetime. But part B, a critical part, a very important part in this, if you will, bifurcation of the title to the property, is the remainder interest. Who is going to have the interest in the property when the life tenant is no longer living? Because, hey, let's get a little comical here. We all are going to die, right Lockwood?
Yeah.
I mean, life is a finite thing.
Yeah.
And so we clearly know that the life tenancy will expire. And when the life tenancy expires, who is then going to inherit the property? Who will then have the title to the property? So, of course, Lockwood, you can only begin to imagine how this dynamic, you know, it's a little bit, it can be, at many times, it's a little bit of an oil and water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, I think the property isn't being maintained properly.
Right.
I think the property needs a new roof. I don't think the property got properly repaired.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm into the tax office and I see that the taxes aren't being paid. So there many times can be conflict between the remainderman and the life tenant. And there has to be some resolution of that conflict. And we've had many cases in our office through the years where we've had to get in the middle of that.
Wow.
I will say that the life tenant has a tremendous amount of authority relative to some of those issues that I just mentioned. They, you know, the remaindermen do not even have the right to go on the property. They would be trespassers, if you will, unless there were arrangements made, permission granted, or something of that nature. The life tenant is entitled to the 100% complete and quiet enjoyment of the property. So as you can imagine, this can set up scenarios that can create conflict. One of the questions that I always ask folks is, well, you know, you want your spouse to have this lifetime right to the property. How is the relationship between the
right.
spouse, you know, and
yep.
your children from your prior marriage? I mean, are they all going to, you know, get along? I mean, what is going to happen here? And let's kind of talk about that. Because,
yep.
and will your spouse have the resources to maintain this property,
mm-hmm.
the taxes, the insurance, the upkeep, the repairs, all of those kinds of things?
You know,
of the fundamental beginnings of understanding a life estate is that it's a merger, if you will, of two entirely different interests in real property. There is the interest of the life tenant. There's the interest in real property of the remainderman. Another thing that just really, really flabbergasts clients, and it actually kind of sometimes comes as a surprise even to we lawyers, is that the life tenancy has significant value. Based on the life expectancy, as Wes mentioned, of the life tenant, we were looking at one yesterday. I think the gentleman told me he was 77 years old, and the life tenancy was worth about 42%.
Wow.
Nearly 50% of the property. So if this property is going to sell for, let's say, you know, $1 million,
mm-hmm.
then $420,000 of that will be the life tenant, and the difference in the math would go to the remainderman. Well, goodness gracious, that's a lot. Each interest, the life tenant as well as the remainder interest, has a value that can be calculated and would be used if for some reason the property were to sell. And this can sometimes become a bone to pick between the remainderman and the life tenant, which is easily, Lockwood, why you can see that when I
right.
am just told, well, I just want my wife to have a life estate, or
mm-hmm.
I just want my certain child to have a life estate, you know, I have to kind of pause as a lawyer and dig a little bit deeper, because I don't want to set up a situation where when the rubber hits the road, you know, we have a significant problem.
Cecil, one quick question, and I want to make just a quick note here as well. Of course, you're listening to Let's Talk Legal, and that's Cecil Harvell. And earlier we were listening to comments by Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And I do want to remind you that number, 252 area code 726-9050. You know, Cecil, in our conversations in the past, and I want to just make comment. I have been listening. I want you to make note of this fact. You have said specifically that you're always cautious on the issue of estates. So many times you'll have clients come in and say, I want to talk to you about an estate and or trust. And you've always been very cautious about that. And I see this as one of those examples where if you create a trust or an estate management system, that you have to look forward into the potential conflicts. And I can imagine in this particular case, on the case of a life estate, is it something that's built into the discussion or into the contract that allows both the beneficiary of the life estate as well as the remainderment to make that decision to sell? Because I can see now that for example, a parent says, I want this life estate to stay in place so that the income from this estate will go to a child in need or something of this nature. Is that one of those discussion topics that you start off with?
Well, it absolutely is, Lockwood. And I think one of the ways to say this is that, you know, we are the last stop, you know, here, you know, Lockwood. I mean, if we put a document together and then, of course, that's the final document, which we have to make the assumption that every document we prepare will be, in right. fact, the last document. There's mm-hmm. no promise at all that it would ever be amended or revoked, modified. We have to assume that the document that we put before a client to sign, it will be, in fact, the final document. Mm-hmm. And if it is the final document and there hasn't been adequate discussion, then even though we were the last stop, if you will, on the document, we didn't do a very thorough and sifting job of explaining all of the consequences of the document that the client signed. Wow. So these things need to be talked about, and this is the, I always talk about clients give us, quote, all the pieces of their puzzle. You give me all of the pieces of your puzzle, and then my duty is to talk with you about how we put the puzzle back together again.
Right.
And, of course, when one of the pieces of the puzzle is, well, I want a life estate for my spouse or for my child or for my grandchild, then that's a piece of the puzzle that is going to require some more conversation. And many times after it's more appropriately explained, more thoroughly explained, rather, the client will back away from that idea. It's a very easy thing to say, as I said at the very beginning of our program today. It's just so easy for a client to just think at home and come into the law office and say, "Oh, I want so and so to have a life estate," and they haven't thought about all of these other issues because they're not supposed to have to think about it. That's our job. That's the lawyer's job to think about it and to explain the consequences of the request that they are making. After all, we're the lawyer. We're the ones who have the experience. We've seen the front end of the planning,
right.
And then we, of course, now through experience, have seen the back end, if mm-hmm. you will, Lockwood, of how these things play out in real life when the rubber hits the road. How does the life estate really play out? So we've had a lot of experience in this area, and so there needs to be a full and thorough discussion of a life estate, which is the topic of the day.
And as you've pointed out, Wes, I want to go to this topic you yeah. mentioned earlier. It's the dynamics of life; they change constantly, and of course, we don't anticipate those issues, nor have we seen them, but you in many instances have. That's one of the benefits of your experience. What happens in the case of a remainderman deciding that the tenant, the life tenant, is not taking care of the of the asset. How do you approach that? What are the options?
Well, right. I can tell you right now that goes over to Mr. Collins and his staff.
Yeah,
I'll let Mr. and we've had several of those files.
Really?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Right.
Yes.
So the life estate holder has a duty to avoid waste.
Okay.
So they can't. They have to reasonably maintain the property. They can't run. They can't have the property run down. They can't. I mean, let's say that they, have tons of animals in the property.
Mm-hmm.
And, this is not being maintained, and this, so on and so forth. So the remainder interest holder would have a right to sue the life estate holder.
Wow.
For waste being done to the property. So that's kind of the end game. As you know, we oftentimes try to resolve those issues prior to filing any kind of litigation, any kind of lawsuit, by writing a demand letter, setting forth the obligations of the life estate holder, and letting them know that in the event they don't do that, they don't maintain the property and avoid waste, then they're subjecting themselves to a lawsuit for waste. Now, the effects of that lawsuit, you can't terminate the life estate as a result of the lawsuit. It's a lawsuit for damages.
Oh.
So basically where you are is, okay, we would, through the litigation, have the right to be able to inspect the property, and we would likely have, an expert come in and look at what kind of waste is being caused, and that expert, whether it be a general contractor or whether it be, whomever, to provide an opinion as to what the value of the harm to the property is. How have you diminished the value? And that would be our measure of damages. So, that's the way that we go about doing that. Another thing that you mentioned a moment ago, Lockwood, going into, some of the planning aspects of this, as you said a moment ago, life kind of twists and turns, and you don't know, how relationships are going to be in the future and so on and so forth. If you're in a situation from a planning perspective where you want, let's say, a child to have a right to live in a property that you own, maybe mm-hmm. it's not your home, maybe it's somewhere else, and therefore you come to the lawyer and you say, Mr. Lawyer, I want my son to have a life estate in this property while I'm living. That's what I want him to have, and let's put that in place. Well, the lawyer, if he's thinking about this closely, is probably going to push the pause button on that and probably recommend not to do that. But in the event you want to leave a life estate in the property for your son or an interest in the property after you die, let's do that through your will. Let's not do it through a deed where we convey the life
estate.
Why? The reason why is because once you convey that life estate to the son, well, let's say the relationship changes in the future. You can't retract it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't pull it back.
Right.
But in the event that the relationship changes, or the son, maybe the son gets into legal trouble. Maybe the son has to file a bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the son has a substance abuse issue. Maybe the son goes through a divorce. Well, you're subjecting that property to the twists and turns of the son's life. Wow. If he has a conveyed interest in a life estate. But in the event you just handle that through your will, then you can retract it. You can change your will. So, that's kind of just planning 101 when we're talking about the difference between setting up an estate plan to provide to your loved ones what you want to provide to them through a will, / trust, or just a will, or doing it by deed. What folks need to understand is once you convey by deed, there's no pulling it back. That's a done deal. The deed is done, as
okay.
they say. It's over. Signed, sealed, and delivered. You can't undo it because the title is then in the name of, under this scenario, the son.
We're, so, We're talking with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Wes just a moment ago. And if, as I mentioned earlier, Cecil has always been very cautious about the whole establishment of estates and trusts. And as we wrap it up, Wes, I think you said a moment ago it's planning 101. From the perspective of you, the experienced attorneys at Harvell and Collins, maybe so. But for those of us who are civilians out here, we think about these things and say, well, this is a great way to accommodate my my passing, and I can assure my spouse, my surviving family, certain benefits. But I think this is important. Have that conversation with Harvell and Collins, as we just heard a moment ago. And Wes, I appreciate that description. When the deed is done, it is done. And to the audience listening, ask the question. We've heard numerous times Cecil and Wes say, just ask the questions, and don't hesitate to ask that question of Harvell and Collins. And again, that number, 252 area code 726-9050. Wes, that's a great description. The deed is done. And Cecil, to on your behalf, your constant caution about such things of this nature are very obvious, the benefits of that. To both of you, thank you for being with us this afternoon here on Let's Talk Legal.